how he viewed the world. Life was a series of trials one could overcome with enough dedication, levity, and a little help from others. It can be hard for the modern eye to discern the quality in silent animation. It's often ramshackle, fuzzy, and jerky, and that's before it gets ported to a subpar VHS tape and then compressed for streaming video. But what's amazing about early Disney work is its ambition. Even back then, Walt was trying to say something. Drive is hard to sustain. Walt in Wonderland, a book of the early Kansas City years, points out that Walt's later work gets worse. Corners were found and cut. Movement was cycled. Jokes from last year were lifted wholesale. Casey produced two shorts, but neither sold, leaving Walt deep in the red. He once dodged a process server who tried to serve a Walt Denzi because, technically, he was not Walt Denzi. To keep momentum going, he invited more artists to KC, luring them with a share of future profits. The more people he brought aboard, though, the more the existing employees realized that Walt's promises were as hollow as a wooden leg. When Mighty KC struck out, it left behind two films, some equipment, and thousands in unpaid debt. Walt wasn't even 21. He might not have been legally allowed to run a company, yet he had bankrupted three in a row. That was but a flesh wound to Walt, who took the completed cartoon footage and founded a fourth company. Chapter 3 23 Skidoo 1923 Walt Disney's fourth company, Laugh-O-Gram, named after his one success, began with a venture capital infusion of $15,000, borrowed from friends and neighbors. Walt's Garage College Cartoon School was once again in session, under a new name. Ub did his best to stay away, satisfied with his ad agency paycheck, but Walt promised him $50 a week, which biographer Neil Gabler credits to Walt's dizzy unreality. After a few months, Ub succumbed, because who could resist? He joined a dozen or so other artists in Walt's garage, mostly teenagers receiving training. They would analyze bits and pieces of cartoon film stolen from movie houses. Walt didn't want to just animate gags. He wanted to tell stories. He yearned to tell stories. Not original stories, mind you. Why reinvent the wheel? But Disney-fied stories. If Little Red Riding Hood could become a hit, 100 more such fables were waiting in the public domain wings. Walt and Ub handled what was called the key poses of each shot. Depending upon the complexity of the action, there can be lots of key poses, or just a few. The trainee artists sketched the progressive steps between. They were called in-betweeners. In-betweeners would graduate into handling key poses themselves. Laugh-O-Gram also switched to the new fad of cell animation. In cell animation, characters were still drawn on paper, but that paper was placed under a sheet of clear acetate made of cellulose, a cell. The cell was traced over with ink, creating a cleaned-up duplicate of the drawing. After it dried, the cell was laid over a background image and photographed. Cell animation allowed for intricate scrolling backgrounds, sometimes drawn on rolls of shelf paper, stronger blacks and purer whites, and vastly more complex types of animation. In a final attempt to expand, Laugh-O-Gram would think bigger than Kansas City. Walt hired a sales manager to sell his cartoons and sent him to New York City. After a month whooping it up on Walt's dime, he returned with a deal. Walt and Ub were ecstatic. This would finally put them on the map. Unfortunately, the fairy tale that best describes this deal is not Little Red Riding Hood, but Jack and the Beanstalk. Their valuable commodity had just been exchanged for what would amount to a handful of beans. It seemed like a lot, though. $11,000 for six cartoons. Walt had struck it rich. Assuming a 6-minute runtime, the fee worked out to about 35 cents a frame, more than Walt and Ub collected for a foot of animated film just a year ago. Too good to be true. And it was. The $11,000 was due on delivery. The down payment Laugh-O-Gram received for all six films was $100, not even a hundredth of the total. One C-note, in other words, would have to pay for the creation of all six films. Each dollar would have to stretch to cover 388 frames of finished art. That math should have been a warning that Walt was dealing with fast-talking dreamers. He knew those guys. He saw one every time he looked in a mirror. But Walt wanted to believe it. So work began on five new cartoons. Walt ended up borrowing thousands to keep his production chugging along. He lined up new investors to simply pay off existing investors. He snuck out of his office so he didn't have to pay back rent and scribbled a new address on his business cards. To save costs, each fairy tale story used the same cast of four. A boy, a girl, a black cat, and a white dog. Less time designing characters meant more time doing finished work. This also made the cartoon seem, to the animators if not the moviegoers, like a stable of photo players. Who were those animators? A bunch of kids with no prior experience. Two of them, Hugh Harmon and Rudy Ising, had names that sounded like a musical group when run together. Harmon Ising. There was also a Jewish guy, Isidore Frehling, who Hugh started to call Frizz, and an Arkansas guy, Carmen Maxwell. Their brief time as Laugh-O-Grammers would set the course for their lives. They learned that animation is the art of concatenating hundreds of thousands of images, keeping the movement ratios not only correct, but correct in relation to each other. One lapse, one too slow or too fast action, and reality goes out the window. It looks like a sloppy mess right up until the emulsification at the end. Speaking of sloppy messes, the New York distributor for the six fairy tales went conveniently bankrupt right as Walt shipped the films off. This meant Walt never got paid. Worse, it meant the footage was no longer Walt's property, and the company never had to give it back. All Walt's scraping was for naught. He began to live like a vagrant, washing once a week, only eating food others bought him, and almost missing a business meeting because his one pair of shoes was being repaired. His only money came from the occasional footage he sold to newsreels, and that was only if Kansas City was in the news. While Walt's efforts may have looked like a Ponzi scheme on paper, he was trying his best to fulfill his broken promises. In film, a durable strip of white stock is spliced on before the actual film. This is called the leader. The leader's job is to absorb damage. In this period of his life, Walt was a leader, all right. His indefatigable charisma, Walt's soul must have been cork, made people follow him like he was the Pied Piper. This first-on-the-battlefield leadership would never fail to bring in new recruits for the next project. Cult of personality, reality distortion field, the vision thing, whatever you want to call it, Walt had it. But leadership doesn't come with a paycheck, so Walt kept trying anything and everything to stay afloat. He made a brush-your-teeth feature for a local dentist. He filmed babies for new parents. Since motion picture cameras were expensive, Walt's Universal cost $300. He joined a civic group to make business contacts. To brighten his spirits, Walt sometimes carried the unloaded camera around, pretending to film. Ub, who hadn't been paid for months, let Walt move in with him and his mother. Ub concocted a comedy series called Laughlets, focusing on camera tricks. One week, for instance, Ub filmed himself smushing a clay bust of President Harding, then ran it in high-speed reverse to make him appear to be a 60-second Michelangelo. One of Walt's final ideas was a variant of the Fleischer Brothers' Out of the Inkwell, which featured cartoons coming alive and jumping off the drawing board. Walt, an avid moviegoer, knew that no one had flipped that idea. No one had put a person in an animated film. That's what Walt would do. He'd call it Alice's Wonderland. Walt's job was to find a young actress. Ub's slightly tougher job was to figure out how to put her in a cartoon. They both succeeded. Walt found 4-year-old Virginia Davis with doll-like ringlets of hair. Ub, for his part, decided to film Virginia against a white background. When the film was developed, the white background showed up as clear. Virginia was basically a photographed animation cell now, with no background. That film would be bipacked on top of new blank film, and re-threaded in the camera. Then Ub would photograph separate animation and background cells, laboriously drawn to interact with Virginia. To get Alice into Wonderland, Ub had invented chroma key compositing. This is the process where removing a color from an image allows a filmmaker to overlap a second image on top. Today it's called green screening, and you can't make a fantasy movie or a weather broadcast without it. The idea still worked back when film was chemical instead of digital. Ub Iwerks was the first to pull it off. Walt drummed up some interest from New York bookers for the Alice idea, and had Laugh-O-Gram start work on the project. This was on spec, so once again everyone was working for free. Ub was already owed over $1,000, though. Being asked to volunteer was the last straw. He boomeranged back to the ad agency. He and Walt were still friends, but Walt was the sort of dreamer who always walked away unscathed from disasters. Ub was the one left holding the bag. Ub's leaving doomed Laugh-O-Gram. It would be Walt's fourth bankruptcy. After months of waiting, Walt finally received a response from New York about Alice. An animation distributor for Universal named Margaret Winkler had reached out. Universal was no fly-by-nighter. It was the oldest movie studio in America. It already distributed Felix the Cat and Out of the Inkwell, and it liked the idea of a live girl in a cartoon world. The distributor would take a look at a completed short. No promises. A year earlier, that would be a done deal, but the offer came too late. One source has it that a creditor possessed the only extant copy of Alice's Wonderland. Walt owed money left and right, and was running short of new artists who would work for free. When some of Walt's precious existing footage was lost, when the summer heat ruined the negatives, it seemed even the heavens were colluding against him. He had burned the city's candles at both sides, leaving nothing but burnt ends, and not the barbecue kind. Laugh-O-Gram closed its door in July 1923, a little more than a year after it opened. Walt and Ub didn't go broke, Roy later clarified. They had receivables they couldn't collect on. But it was a fine distinction. Ub, bag in hand, handled much of the bankruptcy proceedings, mostly so he could parcel out the locked-up animation equipment. Thanks to Ub, Laugh-O-Gram would eventually pay its debts. If Walt Disney's story ended here, if he had done nothing else, he would be remembered as the Svengali to the first generation of animation greats. Kansas City, basically the geographic center of the continental U.S., became ground zero for a new American art form. Friz Freleng, the most well-known of the Laugh-O-Grammers, helped develop the Warner Brothers stable of cartoon greats, gave the world the Pink Panther, directed 266 shorts, and carted home 4 Oscars over his career. Hugh Harmon and Rudy Ising founded Looney Tunes. Carmen Maxwell helped make MGM Studios, which gave the world Droopy Dog and Tom and Jerry. Walt's days in Kansas City were numbered. New York seemed a likely place to move to. With his experience, he could grab an animation job. But his new dream was the real movies, and the new home of the motion picture industry was in California. Like the pioneers who first settled the Midwest, Walt would find his fortune by heading west. He left Missouri so broke he had to sell his camera for travel money. He was skinny as a rail from his harrowing experience in Kansas City, Roy noted. His few clothes were worn thin as well. In his cardboard suitcase was the lone uncompleted reel of Alice footage Ub had shot. He had finally gotten a copy. In a sort of Bronx cheer to his bank statement, Walt rode to L.A. in first class. He would enter the film world in style. That break between Walt and Kansas City was clean. Most locals have no idea Walt Disney was a local. For Walt, Kansas City was ultimately no more than where he had to leave to arrive at his true destination. Chapter 4. Alice Blue, 1924. Why did the movies pick Los Angeles? Lots of sun, which was necessary in the days when sets were roofless. Very little rain, also key for roofless sets. Lots of variety in its geography. Desert, mountains, seaside, farms, even some suburban and city life. Plenty of room to build giant set pieces such as the ancient Babylon of Intolerance, which gave Hollywood one of its many nicknames. Also, L.A. was 3,000 miles away from Thomas Edison, who was demanding a royalty patent from anyone who used a film camera. L.A. doubled in population between 1920 and 1930 as the seat of a new industry, movies. That industry had a very busy year in 1923, but every year was busier than the last. Harold Lloyd's Safety Last featured what would be the acrobatic comedian's signature stunt, hanging off the hands of a clock tower. Lon Chaney's Hunchback of Notre Dame hit theaters, along with new works by Jackie Coogan, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, and Clara Bow. Trumping them all was Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments, whose massive Exodus scenes were filmed in a groundbreaking process known as Technicolor. After arriving, Walt immediately started working the shoe leather beat, but he didn't make any connections hanging around the set of epics like Ben-Hur. He couldn't even land work as an extra. The studio gates were crowded with those looking for their big break. Even when Walt booked a day's work riding in a cowboy film, it rained, canceling the shoot. As a backup plan, Walt sent New York distributors a query letter about the Alice cartoons. He also pitched a Laugh-O-Gram-style weekly cartoon series to L.A. theaters. He was also hawking some old comic strips he had drawn. If none of those panned out, how about real estate? Walt often talked back then about how if he only had $10,000, he could become a regular George Babbitt. Entrepreneurs like gamblers didn't quit. They couldn't. Walt's dream to be an artist was evolving. The truest art, according to Edward Earl Purinton in 1921's Independent, is business. Fortune smiled on Walt from New York City and the guise of Universal's Margaret Winkler. Winkler had just lost the rights to Felix the Cat when the print of Alice's Wonderland came over the transom. She was looking for a replacement. Here Walt was, not only with a clever new idea, but one with its own black cartoon cat. He was technically called Julius, drawn larger and with smaller eyes than Felix, but he was basically Felix, down to the tail that could be transformed into a nick-of-time invention, like a hook. In its letter, Universal offered Walt no advance, but would pay $1,500 each for 6 Alice cartoons. You hear that, world? Walt the cartoon mogul was back. Also, Walt the insolvent was back. He broke into Roy's hospital in the middle of the night to share the good news. More shoe leather followed. Walt moved in with his uncle and borrowed $500 of capital. A buddy from Kansas City, a silent movie organist named Carl Stalling, chipped in $75. Walt didn't have Ub with him, but he had Roy, who had years of financial experience. Roy had also run the family farm during their father's bout of typhoid fever. Roy's business acumen, combined with Walt's artistry, might keep this new L.A.-based venture afloat. But being good with a dollar did not a CFO make. I was just a normal guy, Roy admitted, and I learned at the company's expense. Learn he did. Walt could start a dozen businesses, but needed Roy to build one into a success. Right off the bat, Roy proved his worth, improving Walt's deal with Universal. That contract for 6 cartoons became 12, and the price was upped from $1,500 each to $1,800. Net profits tripled overnight. Walt's first act toward a successful business was the same one that pushed the Disney sons away from their father, entrusting his finances to family. Since this was a family business, the name would be the Disney Brothers Cartoon Studio. They needed staff. Too bad Ub Iwerks was 1,500 miles away. Many of the other Laugh-O-Grammers were busy as well, working on a short-lived animation studio of their own called Arabian Nights. Walt would have to start from scratch. He also contacted the parents of Virginia Davis, telling her she had a job out west. Virginia happened to be getting over her own bout of pneumonia, and doctors had told her, just like Roy, to move to a warm climate. This boded well for Walt, whose universal contract was contingent on the Mary Pickford-esque Virginia being their cinema actress. She and her family moved to L.A. Live-action production on the series was informal. Roy was the cameraman, his even temper well-suited for turning the crank. Walt rounded up neighborhood tykes to fill out the cast. They aimed to be a true competitor to The Little Rascals. The live-action bits would bookend a cartoon middle, but not for long. Walt had a long-term plan to segue the Toons out of the Alice serial. Ideally, in a year or two, her adventures would be exclusively live-action. Walt could finally put down the pencil. Until then, his days were spent folded over an animation desk. In some ways, Los Angeles was better for animating than Kansas City. No repainting a cell because of cracked frozen ink. On the other hand, summer sweat could ruin a perfectly fine sketch. But L.A. offered Walt a community of like-minded filmmakers. Why, just down the road on the farm where Universal shot its films, they offered a nickel tour of the studio. Today, it would be uncommon for a single woman such as Margaret Winkler to be in the position she was at Universal. In 1923, it was shocking, and it did not last long. Once she got married, her new husband decided that her job would become his job. Universal gained a de facto new distributor, and since the distributor had final cut, Margaret Winkler's editorial scissors now passed to her new husband, Charlie Mintz. Mintz, a young man with an old man's sour face, decided Margaret's policy of paying people on time was a sucker's game. He also decided that they were making less money with Alice than Felix, not because audiences wanted Felix back, but because Walt wasn't good enough. Mintz decided to withhold back payment until work improved. He was a no-carrot, all-stick manager. In response, Walt did something unusual. He agreed with Mintz. An Alice cartoon was nowhere near as good as a Felix. Those years teaching animation college had given Walt an eye for talent. He knew Disney's work was not on par with Otto Messmer's. Only Ub Iwerks was ever that good. If only they had Ub back, Disney Brothers could dramatically improve its quality. No one in history schmoozed in a letter better than Walt Disney. He could flatter the stripe off a skunk. His letters abounded with ellipses, bold words, underlines, profanities, excoriations, compliments, and enough hyperbole to impress Paul Bunyan. Using the full force of his powers, Walt wrote to Ub, tempting him to join Disney Brothers in the City of Angels. Was Ub upset that Walt made $5 more per week back home? Well, Ub would make $5 more than Walt. That would be a small price to reunite the bifurcated Wizard of Oz, the genial bolster, and the masterful man behind the curtain. Ub was torn. He was already making more than Walt's best offer. Was moving cross-country for an unreliable friend worth it? But in the movies? But for a pay cut? To do what he loved at a shoestring operation? Some of Walt's recklessness must have rubbed off because Ub said yes. Ub and his mother, driving out west, solved two problems at once. The other was that someone needed to transport Virginia's family car out from Kansas City. Ub's first job for Disney Brothers, then, was as a driver. Walt and Ub took different approaches to animation. Ub worked top-down. He broke the film down into shots, the shots down into frames, and the frames down into geometric symbols. This was one secret to his lauded speed. He had turned himself into a one-man assembly line. And his method worked for anyone. Ub could draft a platoon of hands to create shots his way, and have them quickly up to speed. Walt was the opposite. He went frame by frame, gag by gag, building moments up and out. We only live 1 second at a time, and so did Walt's characters. This made him less efficient than Ub. No one was as efficient as Ub, but it had its advantages. You were always surprised by what a Walt character did, because Walt himself was surprised, thinking moment to moment aligned with his mercurial personality. It also made him a different sort of delegator than Ub. If Ub were a factory foreman keeping his staff as busy as possible, Walt was the plant owner matching employees with the right jobs. It was a constant balance. Each new task, each new hire, each new Mint's directive might mean an organizational overhaul. This ability of Walt's, more than anything else, was responsible for his ascent. He was a manager savant. The art of being the boss was part shepherd, part patriarch, and part taskmaster. Employees would joke that Walt demonstrated precisely zero of management books's successful tendencies, yet men kept lining up to work for him. Why? Maybe because management was the art of pretending to be a leader. Walt never had to pretend. Soon after Ub arrived, Walt retired from animation. "Walt virtually never put a pencil to paper after I came west to work for him," Ub said. 4 years or so of steady drawing had cured him of the desire to ever draw again. "I never made a drawing that I liked," Walt later said. Lily saw retirement as a step up. He was so much more a director than an artist. The Disney style that the world soon began to notice was Ub Iwerks's personal style. Ub was able to think and draw in four dimensions, capturing the wheels within wheels. But even that was trumped by something else Ub brought to the animator's table. As Leonard Mosley points out, Ub's greatest gift was to sense what Walt was aiming for and produce it for him. This complemented Walt's greatest gift, knowing how to access the greatness of others. In bringing Ub on board, Salieri had just hired Mozart. This freed Walt's energies to other aspects of movie making. Timing was everything in both comedy and animation. A missing frame here or held exposure there made all the difference in a joke working or not. Walt was able to turn supervision into its own invisible art, suggesting a wealth of changes to improve the final shot. These extra steps cost time and money, but produced cartoons of higher quality. This is not to say Walt was an academic. His humor remained, as one Disney animator put it, rural. Cow udders, people's pants falling down, animals chasing and fighting each other. "We did pretty crude stuff," Ub admitted. Laugh seemed Ub's one weak point. He could animate Walt's coarse jokes with aplomb, but his own attempts at gags were almost non-existent. "He really didn't have much of a sense of humor," according to Seamus Culhane. One Ub joke was for a 6-cylinder car to have an 8-cylinder engine inside. Ub also once said he was in the boomerang business when trying to sell his art, and that 90% of my work never failed to come back to me. Cue the crickets. As the cartoons got better, the live-action scenes got worse. Walt was at his wit's end coming up with new pathways to cartoon land, and it was a bother to leave the studio to film exterior shots. The bookends began to drag down the cartoon middle. Fantasies about live-action directing were replaced with fantasies of removing the live-action altogether. Animation and live-action were Walt's alternating wife and mistress. The way Walt went about eliminating some of the live-action was true to his form. First, he figured his cost savings from cutting all the out-of-studio location shooting. It was enough to hire an extra animator. Then he hired that animator. Then he started a cost-cutting campaign which revealed the studio was, lo and behold, over budget, and that the best way to trim the fat was removing location shooting. After that financial do-si-do, Alice would become a permanent resident of Cartoon Land. As the Alice comedies continued, Ub strengthened his team's skills. That team now included the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of animation, Rudy Ising and Hugh Harmon, whom Walt had wooed from Missouri. The team used to take educated guesses where Alice would be in any given shot. Now they made traveling mats of the negatives, which gave the animators a frame-by-frame performance capture of Alice. This let her interact with cartoons, dance with them, or even hold hands. For extreme actions, Alice herself was animated, though not always convincingly. Alice's cat Julius was animated in what was called a rubber hose animation style. His limbs moved in boneless serpentine rhythm, beautiful as waving ribbons. In early cartoons, he resembled a statue with twirling arms, but he was a true character now, a jolly prankster. Rudy Ising credited Ub for this evolution, explaining that Ub trusted his animators enough to use the model sheet as an inspiration, not a stencil. What audiences saw with Julius was animators going off book, improvising, a jazz solo. Abstract Julius and Concrete Alice were a great pair. Rubber hose creatures were protean beings, able to contort their bodies without harm or pain. This lack of physical consequences made them celebrities of celerity. People cared about their personalities, since when nothing can stop you from what you want turns out to define you. Similar archetypes are found in samurai and Western films. One Alice film, Alice the Toreador, shipped on New Year's Eve in 1924. At the 2:11 mark, a crowd of animals, including a bear, ride a trolley to the bullfight, then stroll into the arena. Ub had drawn overlapping layers of animals that advanced at different speeds. It doubled the appearance of the crowd. Small actions like that made Disney cartoons seem bigger. There was just more going on. Look closely. The bear has changed shape a bit, and now resembles the Terry Toons bear featured in Two Slick Traders, with big rounded ears that seem to float like balloons above a long gray snout of a nose. He's the only one in line who's smiling. His pear-shaped face even resembles a smile. Years before his debut, Ub's Mickey Mouse shines. He also shows up in Alice the Peacemaker. Speaking of mice, the two Disney brothers were still living poor as a pair of church mice. All company profits were being plowed back into the product. Quality was an unquenchable void. As the cartoons got better, Walt and Roy shared a single lodging room and split a single meal at dinner time. They took only enough salary to cover rent. This frugality allowed them to move to a bigger office space on Hyperion Avenue, a former bottling plant down the hill from Griffith Park. The space was christened with a prescient image. Someone at Disney Brothers drew Walt surrounded by cartoon mice. The bigger space gave them room for more talent, such as a high school soda jerk with some yearbook samples. This kid was Les Clark, the first of the legendary Disney animation cadre known as the Nine Old Men. For now, Les worked the camera and brushed up on his skills by inking cells. Walt envisioned a big Disney sign over the new Hyperion studio to let people know this was where the magic happened. But his vision did not include the word brothers. It must have been an awkward conversation when he told Roy he wanted a sign reading not Disney Brothers Studio, but Walt Disney Studios. He wanted to rename the company to highlight himself and exclude Roy. Roy protested at first. Without him, Walt would be on bankruptcy number 5. But there was a cold logic to the decision. Walt was the creative one, the artist. He was getting more of the profits, too, at 60%. It was his company more than Roy's. In later years, Roy even took credit for the rebranding idea. Roy's abdication from the company identity also showed up in the disgraceful balance sheets. Some employee paychecks came with instruction not to cash them. Other paychecks simply didn't come. Walt would forgo a salary for weeks, then give himself a $25 raise. Perhaps to make up for this, Roy would give generous advances when he could. And he asked for advances from Mintz for not yet completed shorts. A more forceful business partner would buckle down on Walt to do more with less, to meet deadlines, to be reliable instead of inspired. But Walt was the star to which they'd hitched their wagon. Roy's task was figuring out how to skate on thin ice until Walt's next idea landed. If that meant sucking up pride and filming another Kansas City dental hygiene strip for extra cash, so be it. Roy let Walt win most games of this lifelong wrestling match. Staying in red ink gave them more black ink to animate with. Besides, now that his name wasn't on the sign, the Disney Brothers Studio wasn't on the perpetual brink of collapse. All credit and creditors went to Walt Disney now. Chapter 5 Rabbit Season, 1927. After shepherding Alice through over 50 cartoons, Walt, Roy, and Ub were beat. The live-action planning and filming was a drain, but the actual cartooning was a bigger joy than ever. If only they could lose Alice and make a flat-out Julius cartoon. Unfortunately, Charlie Mintz disagreed. In fact, Mintz wanted to replace Virginia Davis with a younger girl, maybe someone with a Clara Bow haircut. Walt and Ub recast it as ordered, but downplayed the new Alice. She ended up a guest star in what was becoming Julius's cartoon. Mintz didn't like Julius. There were too many black cats on the screen already. But the grapevine told Walt that Universal was in the market for a rabbit cartoon. As practice, Ub started to draw floppy-eared mice in what would become the last few Alice cartoons. Walt let Charlie Mintz's brother-in-law, George Winkler, who had been helping with camera work, choose the new character's name. He did so in the very rabbity way of pulling it out of a hat. The name was Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. A new star came with a new work contract. Walt had gotten in trouble in the past for deviating from Mintz's schedule, delivering Alice's earlier or later than the scheduled 3-week interval. The Oswald deal required a new cartoon every 2 weeks, so Walt bulked up his animation staff and created two teams. Ub and Friz Freleng headed up one, and Hugh Harmon the other. Oswald and Julius and Mickey, along with Crazy Cat and Felix the Cat, all shared a look. They have a roundness of face, a pudginess of body, with limbs not much more than parallel lines ending in four-fingered gloves. Four fingers wasn't to save animation costs, but because squat characters look more proportioned with fewer fingers. All are about 2 feet high. Considering how creative the stories and gags were, it seems odd how similar the characters were. Dig into your coin purse, though, and you can figure out why. Characters' heads were traced nickels, and their bodies half dollars. Dimes were heads and long shots. Silver dollars were heads and close-ups. Cartoon characters never changed because of change. Oswald the Lucky Rabbit's first appearance was in 1927's Poor Papa, about stork-brought baby bunnies. Oswald's original look was an old, fat, and slow rabbit. Mintz didn't like it and shelved the debut. Ub reworked Oswald, basically drawing Julius, but with long, floppy oval ears. Oswald's new debut was called Trolley Troubles. In hopes of not having to junk a second 7-minute cartoon, staffers came up with the idea of showing Mintz the trolley animation in the rough. They photographed the scratchy keyframes before any in-betweening work was done, and held each frame for 2 or 3 seconds. Mintz's practiced eye could imagine the rest of the cartoon based on this pencil test. The pencil test allowed for changes or suggestions to be incorporated without tearing up a month's worth of work. Mintz liked the idea and approved of the Oswald pencil test, so Trolley Troubles went into production. Pencil test would become another Disney standard. Freed of the Alice bookends, Walt and Ub started building adventures with a demented internal logic. The trolley, for instance, drops dozens of rabbits each time it hit a bump, and it hits a lot of bumps. At one point, Oswald is in a tight spot and removes his own foot for luck, a brilliant skewering of the lucky rabbit's foot superstition. Oswald's ears became lodestones for gags. They could stretch into wings, rise in shock, or hang down like pigtails. Many other Disney hallmarks first appear in Oswald's shorts. The long perspective shots, the funny animals, the casual critter cruelty, and sudden treacle. This was top-notch technical animation, a world away from early Alice reels. Film buff Donald Crafton saw Oswald as the cartoon Buster Keaton, who shared the ability to transform the absurd mechanical environment of the modern world into something useful and humane. In Oswald's world, imagination trumps all. Whatever Oswald can think of to solve a problem, removing his tail to use it as a bat, say, works. That absurdism only played because of Walt's sophisticated and grounding use of film grammar. Cuts on action, multiple angles per scene, perspective shots. Too much abstraction and it's nonsense. Too much concreteness and it might as well be live action. Oswald featured a near-perfect balance, one most every cartoon since has borrowed. Walt decided that Oswald would get a new role each story. One short he would be in love with a girl. In the next short he'd be a hunter. And after that a construction worker. Audiences didn't seem to like it when he switched from, say, knight errant to robotics inventor. They responded to Oswald best when his adventures were limited to the backyard. The artistic word for only showing the familiar is verism. And verism demanded that Oswald, who could go anywhere and do anything, remain in a commonplace rural setting at all times. It would become his Umwelt, his world. Success at work begat romance for Walt, Roy, and Ub. Ub married a fellow displaced Kansan, Mildred Henderson, in 1927, and they soon had a son, Don. Friz Freleng, fresh from Kansas City, covered while Ub was on honeymoon. Walt and an office girl named Lily had been hitched in the summer of 1925. He proposed by saying that since they were chipping in to buy a car, they might as well buy a ring, too. You'd expect a more thrilling proposal for someone with the initials W.E.D. Roy, too, middle-aisled his love, Edna Francis, in 1925. The gang one-upped the tradition of tying tin cans to Roy's bumper by tying on entire trash cans. Walt joked that he married Lily for two reasons, so he could stop paying her, and because when Roy got married, he moved out, and Walt didn't want to cook for himself. "Walt and I were going to wait," Lily said, "but Walt didn't like to be alone." Lily and Edna helped the family business by becoming ink girls. "Walt never thought of anything, I think, except his work and Lily," Edna said. "Mildred Iwerks was busy at home, looking after her new baby and Ub's mother. All three men would go on to be faithful husbands, diligent providers, and warm and loving fathers. Their office jobs just happened to be at an exciting office." The small Disney staff clicked. If two people were ever at odds, Roy was usually able to smooth things over. Before work, they'd all play tennis. After work, they'd go to each other's nearby houses to play cards and drink. Not Ub's house, though. His mom was a killjoy. These nights typically ended with the traditional male expression of emotion, a sarcastic, "Well, get the hell out of here." As more people came on board at Disney, that camaraderie began to dissipate. But Walt always saw his employees as guys he could horse around with and take credit for all the work they did for him. He was upfront about this habit. In his mind, he was selflessly jumping on a grenade. You see, people get territorial and bent out of shape when there's any sort of accurate attribution system. This same logic kept him from ever giving out employee awards. "If there's going to be any awards made, I'm going to get them," he said. By assigning it all to himself, Walt reduced jealousy and kept the peace. How noble. When it came to the look of a cartoon, Walt would later say that money was the only object. Cartoons had become the shabby Cinderella of the picture industry. They were thrown in for nothing as a bonus to exhibitors buying features. I resented that. Ub debuted an amazing series of perspective shots that ratcheted up tension and humor, looked like $1 million, yet could be done on a budget. Walt's studio was making some of the best-looking cartoons in the world, but no one cared. "You could feel rigor mortis setting in," he said later. By the end of the Oswald run, the screen was filled with a dozen characters at a time. Ub had gotten Disney so well-oiled, not even Charlie Mintz could find a technical fault. But Mintz was not the sort of man who left well enough alone. He had recently taken over production and distribution of Crazy Cat, whose creator Bill Nolan had just left. This gave him more control, and let him keep more of the profits. He liked the control. It gave him an idea. Ub was not content with Oswald's success. He was an excellent animator and a natural teacher who bettered everyone around him by instruction and example. He was helpful and supportive to the staff, the glue that held Disney together. Oswald was basically Ub's ideas in action. Roy saw the inherent danger there. If Ub left to start his own studio, half the staff would go with him. To ensure Ub stayed, Roy let him buy into the company. Every pay period, $20 of Ub's paycheck would be deposited into a partnership account. Soon enough, Ub would own one-fifth of Walt Disney Studios. Now Disney's good fortune helped Ub's too. Ub agreed to the partnership, but was still restless. What, after all, were Walt and Roy doing to earn their 80%? George Winkler, Mintz's brother-in-law, had been lollygagging around the studio for a couple of months. When he had a moment alone with Ub, George revealed his real reason for hanging around. He wanted to hire Ub to make Oswald cartoons directly for Mintz. Walt and Roy would be canned, and Mintz would take over as director. It was tempting. Ub would finally receive credit for his work, and people switched animation jobs all the time, especially for a better offer. But no, Walt could be full of himself, but he was a real storytelling talent, not to mention Ub's friend and business partner. Ub turned down Mintz's offer. He felt a duty to warn Walt about Universal's imminent raid. Walt amazingly shrugged it off. Things were going great. There was no need to be worried. Ub was just being paranoid. Ub was floored. How could Walt be so cavalier? Was he not going to respond to Mintz? Did Walt take for granted the sort of loyalty Ub showed for him? Free of doubts, Walt boarded a cross-country train in Los Angeles with Lily. He looked forward to a cheery series of meetings with Charlie Mintz, both men patting each other's backs for a job well done. It's easy to be railroaded with a one-track mind. Disney was currently pulling in around $2,200 for each Oswald, and Mintz had just signed a 3-year distribution deal. Universal had even started cross-promoting Oswald with a line of chocolate bars. Walt walked in prepared to ask for an even $2,500 per reel. With the extra money, he could pay his animators a better wage or afford more film stock. Its price was skyrocketing due to Hollywood's switch to a multiple camera format. He might even be able to take a decent salary. Right now, he couldn't buy a suit without first checking with Roy. This would be where the hard work finally paid off. Mintz was gracious in his first few weeks, but wary. He had recently learned something about Walt Disney he didn't like. Walt was a thief. That Alice cartoon Walt sold ages ago was actually the work of a Kansas City company called Laugh-O-Gram. This misunderstanding had soured him on Disney and helped spur him to cut Walt out of the picture and the picture business. Mintz's graciousness ended when he received a telegram from his brother-in-law, George. The next meeting with Walt pulled his blinders off. Mintz offered Walt not the $300 more a cartoon he wanted, but $800 less. Why? Well, because George had just hired Hugh Harmon, Rudy Ising, and most all of Disney's animators. Everyone but Ub. Walt stayed optimistic. Ub could always train new people to draw Oswald, but Mintz pointed out a line of fine print in the work contract. Oswald the Lucky Rabbit was owned by Universal, not Disney, and Universal was giving Oswald to Harmon and Ising and the other departing animators. In a single blow, Walt lost his business, his friends, and his career. Negotiations continued, but Walt had little with which to negotiate. Mintz, sensing his hot hand, said if Walt wanted to continue work, he would have to first give Mintz the Walt Disney Studios for free. In desperation, Walt paid a visit to MGM, only to be told that cartoons was a dying medium. Walt began to grow serene about matters, sending a telegraph home with the optimism of the recently screwed. "Don't worry, everything okay. We'll give details when arrive." He even warned Mintz prophetically that the new staff wouldn't last long. They would show Mintz just as much disloyalty, Walt warned. Walt faced an ignoble fate as he boarded the train back to Los Angeles, one that was his own damn fault. The Disney trifecta of long hours, low pay, and Walt's arrogance was hardly appealing to employees. For God's sake, Ub had warned him about this. He sat with Lily ruminating, stewing, and licking his wounds. The Walt Disney Studios was now a power trio. Walt could handle the quality, Ub the quantity, and Roy the quarterlies. With their years of experience, Walt could hire, Ub could train, and Roy could pay a new staff. They even had their first trainee, a young volunteer named Wilfred Jackson, who was washing cells and wanted to learn. He would be their first hire. All they really needed was a new star. Whoever he was, he had to be big. Part 2. Inception, 1928. I hope we never lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a mouse. Walt Disney. Chapter 6. Flyover Country. Hugh Harmon and the other departing animators had given their 2 weeks' notice. They assembled what would be Walt Disney Studios' final Oswald cartoon, Hot Dog, while Ub, Roy, and Walt kept their distance. 2 weeks never seemed so long. Ub kept his office door closed. He was curt with his soon-to-be former co-workers, and he left early every day. Walt and Roy left early as well, saying they needed to fix their cars. At one point, Ub hung a black curtain in his office, blocking his view of them. This was the cold shoulder, yes, but there was more to it than that. Ub couldn't afford to wait 2 weeks until he started on Disney's next cartoon, and he wanted to do it in secret. So while everyone else finished The Last Oswald, Ub started the first Mickey. The black curtain was only part of the deception. Employees who stopped by Ub's office would see an Oswald drawing on his desk, but hidden under the Oswald was a Mickey. This sneakiness was Walt's idea. He didn't put it past Mintz to further sabotage Disney by ginning up a rival mouse cartoon just to flood the marketplace. If Mintz never found out Disney's plans, though, he couldn't do anything. The first Mickey Mouse cartoon was designed to be a greatest hits package of the Disney oeuvre. Walt tried to include every great Oswald bit he could, even reaching back for a Julius gag or two. These Disney signatures would be a promise to distributors of what Mickey's could reliably deliver in the future. The last thing Walt wanted was, to quote a Friz Freleng cartoon, demonstrate a dynamic trick he could only do once. Mickey's debut was familiar ground for Disney. Airplanes. Oswald had already starred in an aviation short, The Ocean Hop. So Walt and Ub had recently brainstormed gags about barnstorming. The first Mickey cartoon called Plane Crazy was probably pieced together from The Ocean Hop leftovers. One that would look good without breaking the bank to pull off. Out of necessity, Ub flew solo on Plane Crazy as its lone animator. No in-betweening, no key poses. He did every single frame. Much of this was accomplished via prodigious use of recycled animation. Like many managers, Ub longed to roll up his sleeves and dig in. Here was his chance. Along the way, Ub set an animation record for speed. Crazy Cat's Bill Nolan was considered the Mercury of cartoons. He had once cranked out 600 drawings a day. I did all the animation for Plane Crazy. 700 drawings a day, Ub recalled. Decades later, pride still evident in his words. I really extended myself. 5,000 drawings for a picture took 4 weeks to complete. To most animators, Ub's 100 drawing coverage over Bill Nolan would itself be a hard day's work. Ub considered animation a sport, a race, and this was his chance to set a world's record. Plus, the sooner Ub was finished, the sooner Roy could sell it. Ub was really going above and beyond for Disney. Besides one-man banding Mickey Mouse, Ub had started tipping in an extra $35 a week to the company's coffers, so Walt gave his friend some credit. A credit in the title slide, that is. This was rare. Animators never got billed, but Disney needed to generate oomph, including bragging about its staff. Thus, the first Mickey Mouse was credited as a Walt Disney comic by Ub Iwerks. Even a solo artist like Ub wasn't alone. Someone still had to slap a celluloid layer over top of each drawing and ink it. Someone else had to ensure those cells dried without dripping, running, or smearing. A third someone had to arrange the day's work in order and photograph them against the correct background in the correct position. A final someone had to wash and dry the cells so they'd be ready for reuse. This was standard animation scut work, but with his studio out of bounds, Walt was doing it on the sly in his garage. He roped in his wife and Roy's, and his sister-in-law Hazel Sewell, as the Inking Rotisserie League. In later years, Edna dismissed her plain crazy inking work, claiming not to even remember doing it. Walt in Wonderland described this unbalanced workforce as one general and an army of privates. The garage didn't have a camera, so Walt snuck a cameraman into his own company at night. Ub's meteoric speed was due in large part to not providing finished pencil art. As Leslie Iwerks and John Kenworthy described it, his pre-inked drawings were frequently little more than a combination of circles loosely attached with rubber hose appendages. Mickey's ears and body were rarely colored in. Why? The inker would do it. If Ub drew one half of an arm, he might not bother with the other half. And of course, many of the drawings would be reused. His drawings were dough, not bread. Plain Crazy begins with what would be Mickey's and Minnie's standard credit slate, with Minnie coquettishly swooning on stage right and Mickey holding a cane tipping his hat to her. Their hats are identical, white with a black band, except hers has a massive five-petaled flower in it. This primed the audience to expect a story of a happy couple who, to quote a song about them, live on love and cheese. Following the slate, the screen goes dark, save for the title, Plain Crazy, which stays on screen in the blackness. The dissolve effect was created by an in-camera double exposure, filming the slate and then the title card over top of each other. Because this was a rush job, the inking around the title is imperfect. The black turns into an extreme close-up of a cow's rear end. Scatological humor, the first Disney signature. That cow was one of the characters Ub sketched before hitting on Mickey. Plain Crazy took place in a barnyard, so he added her. Ub would later create Clarabelle Cow, a bovine character who stood erect, wore clothes, and acted quite human. This has led to Council of Trent-worthy discussions about whether the cow seen here is actually Clarabelle or just a cow. Clarabelle perhaps stumbles away from the camera, scratching at herself like a dog to reveal a bustling farm scene. A pig is banging a nail into a long board, hits his hoof, and cries out in mute pain. A dachshund is sawing wood and alternates between one-handed and two-handed holds. A second cow sticks her head out from a barn, happily chewing cud. One duck wanders in carrying some lumber, and then engages in some tug-of-war with a worm. Another duck bangs away on the rudder of a wingless homemade plane, a combination coffin and soapbox derby. A second pig happily tests the propeller. Close to a dozen overlapping characters, their movements cycling in different patterns. Viewers could watch it a dozen times and not catch every detail. The shot isn't done yet. The half-built plane with ersatz landing gear, one wooden wheel and one baby carriage wheel, is having its wings attached. One short-panted mouse supervises. Another rides the wings down a rope. Are these Mickey and Minnie? Mickey and a friend? Unrelated mice? Ub was working too fast for such questions. The world will never know. The wings give a wonderful rotation as they're lowered, a dramatic effect that required a perfect mix of geometry and intuition. This all takes place in 1 20-second shot. Bravura openings, another Disney signature. Ub had to hold all the actions in his head, unable to divvy out anything to others or even discuss the challenges with his crew. But it led to an eidetic